Hey, everybody. Happy Friday. This is Trevin McGee with the Scene Stealers podcast. We're back. We took a week off because I was sick. And we've got our buddy Eric Moline, who couldn't do that away from the mic.
That's just your welcome had back to, burp.
Had to do it. We've got a lot to talk about, so we're going to skip our one things. But we do have a couple of things really fast that Eric and Trey want to mention. So, Trey, what do you have?
Film School, Draft House Film School is showing IF this Saturday at 2 p.m.
Okay.
So come see it.
Go see it.
Scene Stealers is sponsoring the Arts and Crafts Festival at the Screenland Armor August 23rd and 20th. No, 17th. I don't know. It's at the end of August. Yeah, that's all I know. Go to our website to check it out. But here's the cool thing. We've got the premiere of Prince Avalanche in Kansas City, which is David Gordon Green's comeback movie with Paul Rudd and Emile Hirsch in it. Not a broad comedy, from what I'm led to understand.
It's like not the sequel to Your Highness?
No, thank God. You know, he used to make good movies.
He did. Then, George Washington's
incredible. And then we have Drinking Buddies, which is a film with Olivia Wilde, Ron Livingston, Jake Johnson, and Anna Kendrick.
Okay.
And also two documentaries that are supposed to be amazing, one of which I've seen already and is amazing, Big Star, Nothing Can Hurt Me, and then also the Beatles documentary, Good Old Frida, about their secretary and longtime supporter, which is the only movie to ever get actual Beatles songs in it licensed.
All right.
By the Beatles, I think.
Only documentary?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, maybe only movie.
Anyway, actually, go to the Scene Stealers website and, check out the Arts and Crafts Fest that we're sponsoring, and that's that. So the reason we're speeding through this is because we have a lot of movies. I was sick last week, so we had to miss it. So we're going to start by talking about Pacific Rim, then we're going to go into Nicholas Winding Refn's follow-up to Drive, Only God Forgives, and then Eric is going to talk us through our last two movies, and that's going to be it. So we're going to get started.
Way Back and the Hijacking.
Yeah, Way, Way Back and the Hijacking. So let's start with Pacific Rim. We were off, and it really was the worst possible week to be off because I think I don't think the three of us have been like as unanimously excited about a movie, at least this summer, probably in longer than that than we were when we came out of Pacific Rim. So Guillermo del Toro's first movie in a long time. Just a huge kaiju movie, basically. I mean, Trey, you wrote a huge top 10 list about kaiju films. You wrote the review for Pacific Rim. I mean, maybe you'd be best to kick it off, but...
Well, I think everybody knows what Pacific Rim is about right now.
Yeah,
it's
sure.
Been out for a week.
Robots versus monsters.
So let's talk about one thing that we enjoyed about it that we thought was unique.
Cool. Well, I can lead with that then. I really love that Guillermo del Toro didn't totally lose himself with a big budget. I really liked that the attention to detail in both the bots and like in both the Jaegers and the kaiju. But my favorite thing about it is just how, even though it pays all these homages and nods to kaiju and kaiju movies like Godzilla and so many others, I love that there's just sort of a uniqueness to it and an original thread that kind of runs through it. I love the idea of drifting. I love the scale and scope of the film. It just kind of built its own weird little universe and existed completely inside it, and I loved it for that. And I look back at some of the biggest, like, runaway movies anymore, you know, it's so calculated. You know, Avengers is going to make $1 billion, or Dark Knight Rises is going to make, you know, 1.2 billion. That's just how it goes because audience expectations are built in. They're using an existing property and so on. But I look back at, like, runaway summer blockbusters when it wasn't an exact science, and they all kind of did that. Indiana Jones existed in its own weird little universe, and Star Wars existed in its own weird little universe. You know, there were rules that were spoken and unspoken in those. And it was a unique take in a weird enough place, but you could get into it and you could live in there and enjoy it. And that was my biggest thing about Pacific Rim, was that it reminded me of that. It reminded me of being a kid and growing up with, like, this is weird, but it makes sense in the context of this world they've built. So I know that's kind of a nebulous thing, but that's my absolute favorite thing about
the
movie.
You're tapping into something that I actually mentioned in the review, which is they're building a new property. This isn't a sequel. This isn't a reboot. This isn't something that was created based on an existing, you know, series of novels. you know, Beecham made this story for this film, you know, and this is a new property. Yes, there are references to other films that have existed. There are, you know, moments of cliche, moments that we have seen used in other films. But on the whole, as a property itself, it's a new property. And I think that makes it exciting because you don't know what to expect. Every character is on the table. Every character could be sacrificed or die. Every character could get injured or lose an arm or lose an eye. Like, everything is on the table, at least for this film.
Yeah, and just the lack of familiarity is exciting.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Eric, do you have your thing, or do you want me to do mine?
No, I mean, I was going to... You mentioned drifting, and I think for me that was the thing that sold me on the movie the most. Because like you said, there was a ton of stuff that we've seen before. It was like they, you know, mashed up Top Gun together with a bunch of other action movies. And you've got Stringer Bell doing his big Braveheart speech, his big Gladiator speech, and things like that. Mm-hmm. But the reason that all of that worked is because the opening scene in the film features these two brothers who are piloting this robot, and one of them gets violently ripped out of his seat,
cockpit.
Right? And the other guy just experiences the crazy, because of this drift, experiences this awful moment, and it's just magnified by the way that is shot, and
sure,
it is a horrifying opening scene. I was in it from the beginning, and then they go further into what the drift means. And when we'd have the drift between he and the Asian girl later,
Mako,
it's very, very effective.
That's like the most memorable part of the movie for me.
It gives background on Idris Elba, not Stringer Bell, of course, on that character who, for the length of the film, I saw as just this cliched commander type. But the moment we get that backstory, it fills out his character. It rounds him out. We know why he's been a hard ass. And all of a sudden, all that cliche has a little bit of resonance. And then the scene or the movie ends with him doing something heroic. And it feels like something. So you have two scenes in the film, the big moment where he gets everybody to cancel the apocalypse, and then the heroic scene at the end where we know he's going to sacrifice himself, and I'm not giving anything away. If you were watching the film, you would have been able to figure it out. And they work. And the only reason they work is because of this careful build-up beforehand. And I don't think people are giving it enough credit when they say that all the other parts of the story are cliche. They're not giving it enough credit for the one part that truly made those cliched parts work.
Yeah, I mean, it earns its familiar, you know, it totally earns those sort of payoffs.
I was like, rah-rah, ready to go.
Yes, I was very
surprised to feel that way.
I think that's a perfect segue into mine, and one of the things that I think might actually be hurting this film, kind of in the theaters, is that it has both those huge action, and it's got really pretty well-developed characters, but the way they're developed is really savvy. It's little things. It's a moment here and there that kind of build over the course of the movie to really round them out. It's not like one big moment of explication. We're allowed to get that background through visual means because we can go into the memories of certain characters, things like that. But this is both a sort of character-driven drama and a really great action movie.
Yeah, really just fucking awesome action movie when it wants to be.
Exactly. And that I think that somebody who just wants like lowbrow action, like who wants like Transformers 3.5 is going to have moments where they're bored. Those people, like I took Jamie, Trevin took Megan. And again, not bad-mouthing either one of them, but Jamie didn't really like it. Yeah. Megan, I don't think, was totally impressed.
She liked it, but she wanted more monsters. Enough monster fights.
So she was the frat boy. Jamie was the opposite side, where there were those moments of character, but then she tapped out during the monster fight.
Since we're talking about our significant others, my girlfriend really liked it.
Yeah.
Which is weird.
Yeah.
Because I did not expect that.
But believe me, I wouldn't, it's like, I wouldn't want to put anybody in the ring with Jody anyway. So it's like, but kudos to her.
The other thing I wanted to mention, I thought you were kind of going there. It seemed like you were, and then you backed away just to talk about the action, but the thing that we all hated about Man of Steel was this oppressive
lack
of humor.
Yeah.
And in this
movie,
and lack of moral compass.
Well, yeah, oh, definitely, yeah. Definitely. But also the fact that it was completely serious, and you can't have a fucking Superman movie and not have those great little fun moments. And right. This movie has a great comedic subplot
yep.
with Charlie Day He's doing
great.
Charlie Day.
He's
and
so
Ron
great.
Perlman comes in.
As and Vern Gorman.
Yeah, and, Vern Gorman's but he comes great. In as yeah. this black market organ dealer, which helps to make the world feel lived in. Because
yeah.
right.
what a crazy idea that we've been living with them now for
yeah.
7 years or 8 years
yeah.
or whatever it is, that there would be a black market for kaiju lovers and their organs.
And it's
right.
not just that. It's
that works.
It's public kaiju bunkers. It's all of
yep.
those types
yeah, all
of
the little
things.
Details. And yeah, my biggest problem with Man of Steel wasn't the lack of humor. It was how they dealt with destruction on a massive scale
right.
and didn't really...
Yeah.
Didn't really
it,
didn't
right
really humanize
this
it.
Oh,
yeah, this movie
it,
makes
and it humanizes
you,
it.
It totally does. Yeah, the between Mako's like drift flashback where you get to see just the effects on one little girl, that's like
yep.
that was disarming and traumatizing.
Yep.
And mm-hmm. then also when there's that attack on Tokyo and you see the bunkers and you see the panic and the, you know, like all of that goes a long way to make the massive, you know, epic destruction actually means something.
And if I'm correct, I believe there's only one action scene in the middle of a city.
Yeah.
Am I right?
Yeah.
So I've read a lot of critics who were complaining about, oh, it's always raining and they're always in the sea and you can't see anything. And I'm like, well, there's kind of a reason for that.
Yeah,
that would be
the military plan.
They are kind of the first response team that's supposed to keep them away from... Anyway, we don't need to deconstruct that. But I don't like to put the caveat for a summer action movie. You know, I think movies are just movies, but I really loved it. I mean, I gave it, if I didn't get to review it, but it would have been a rock fist way up for me.
How
I
many times
just,
have you seen it?
Just twice. I want to see it a third this weekend.
I've seen it three.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep.
I only saw it once, but I gave it a solid rock fist up.
Yep.
Yours was solid
Mine
as well.
Was solid. Yep.
Yeah. I go way up. Just I think it's just because I'm so burned out and it was so new. You know, I just felt
and,
original.
And that's
and to be
my
fair,
one...
the ending kind of... The ending does kind of fall apart. Like, I didn't really care
yeah.
for the...
A little
the
bit.
It
a little
like
bit.
The Avengers.
It's
the
easy.
Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah, it's easy. It's easy.
But
again,
then they, but
I
then
cared
they
about
totally
the
redeem it. They totally
yeah.
redeem it with the resolution. Like, the last
mm-hmm.
the last shot of the movie and the way that they... The, like, the last thing you see actually totally redeems the way it was so cliched. It ends on a very...
Are you talking about the bumper after the pre?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, not the bumper after the pre, but just the... when. They're both in the water.
Right. Yeah, I
like
agree.
That shot and the way that ends totally redeems the sort of cliche that came before it. So I really liked
so
that.
So the universe, the world, it feels lived in. It feels like something that they could make another movie out of that
mm-hmm.
doesn't
yeah.
have to be this story. It could be another story.
Yeah.
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 Totally.
You know? And
yeah.
that's, I don't know.
I don't know that they're going to get to, but
yeah.
Beecham has already tweeted out that, like, I shared this with a couple of friends of mine that I knew loved this film. Like, loved
this
film.
This is the co-writer of the film?
Yeah.
No,
Travis Beecham.
Yeah, yeah,
and,
yeah.
But
he's the one that came up with the story,
okay.
and then Del Toro and Beecham co-wrote
the
screenplay.
Yeah.
And he said, he goes, "I'm only following the numbers so that I can know whether we get to do the sequel or not because it's fucking bonkers."
Yeah.
So he's already said that we go kind of off the rails with the sequel, which to me, it's like, I mean, there are already rumors of mecha kaiju and human run kaiju and like our people. I mean, there are already these batshit, like awesome classic kaiju tropes. And I would love to see that. I'd
yeah.
love to see that.
Let's hope it sticks around.
Please, for the love of Christ, go and see this again. Give
yeah.
this movie lots
God
of
God knows
lots
you
of
guys
money.
Are.
Yeah.
yeah. I've already seen it twice. I've paid for
three,
it twice.
Yeah,
like,
for
I saw
twice.
It free once, and I've paid for it twice.
So speaking of a movie that you guys saw for free...
Yeah.
and that I didn't get to, Only God Forgives opens today.
It does.
Now, not only in theaters, but also on video on demand.
Oh, yeah.
This
yeah.
is a platform release. It's open everywhere right now.
Yep.
And we got to make this one quick.
Yeah, well,
I'm gonna have to
you know,
it was
Trey's, you know... Trey's been excited about it for a long time, so maybe you should lead us off on this one, or I guess you just kicked off Pacific Rim.
Yeah,
so.
No, I'll lead this one off
okay.
because I think I was more ambivalent about it.
We both, I think everyone here agrees that Drive was
incredible.
Yeah,
it was
so
in
all of our
top tens.
We love Drive. It was I think it was my number one.
It was my number one definitely.
Eric's number two. So we all love Drive. We all expected that. I mean, I've I'm familiar with Rain's work before that, or Refn's work before that, the Pusher series and Bronson and, you know, everything else.
I saw Bronson and Valhalla Rising. Yeah.
So Drive definitely felt like a step above his previous work. And the people that were kind of hesitant to say that, critics that weren't really in favor of it, kind of treated it like it was a flash in a pan and all style and no substance, and just kind of he just hit an artistic sweet spot and that kind of lucked out. After watching Only God Forgives, I don't think they're right, but I think that Only God Forgives gives credence to those complaints. I think Only God Forgives is definitely a step back, and it definitely speaks to a lot of his weaknesses as a director. It's incredibly stylized, incredibly atmospheric. It's also really gratuitous and just kind of nonsensical and bad. I'm trying to speed through it.
I think I disagree with that.
It's a revenge flick with Ryan Gosling, just to kind of build it out. It's a revenge flick set in Thailand with Kristen Scott Thomas shows up. Ryan Gosling he runs a Thai boxing gym and then deals drugs out of the back, basically.
And it's a corrupt or kind of morally ambivalent cop.
Yeah, crazy morally ambivalent cop that kind of has his own sense of justice, gets involved. But basically somebody gets killed, and then
his brother gets killed for doing something
that he should be killed for.
I mean, and so every choice, and I think that's why people are coming down on this one so weird, is that there are people who like praise it ridiculously,
right?
And I think that's kind of unfair, and I think there are people who just hate this film. And I think that's kind of unfair. And I think what Refn is going, because at every single turn, I think it's absolutely intentional, at every single turn, you're just like, why is this person doing this? And he, at every single choice that every single character makes, there are things that you can go, yeah, I might make that choice. But then there are things where you're just like, why would they? Like, everything is complicated. There's nothing that's simple. Like, Ryan Gosling's character,
Julian,
has his brother Billy get killed. Mm-hmm. And he's, you know, Julian is himself, like, he has a violent past that we're told about, but he's very restrained. So he's already this kind of difficult character. And so we're told about that, you know. Why isn't he going and getting revenge for his brother's character, his brother, he seems like a character that would do that,
right?
But there's this back and forth, almost like this sort of Hamlet conundrum, because he's got a parent going, you know, revenge this person, and he's like, it's weird, I don't know that I can do that. He actually has these little moments of indecisiveness that are tantamount to that. I think this is going to be a film that, even though people are really polarized on it, I think it's going to be something that lives in your head, and I think it's going to mature in interesting ways.
I don't know about that.
And you can disagree with me, but I think that ambivalence is what Refn is striving for, and he's striving for ambivalence within his viewers.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's not something that most people are comfortable with.
So because I wrote a column for the Journal World this week that was about how I wasn't able to see the film,
right?
I spent a lot of time reading other people's reviews.
Okay.
And I compiled a list of quotes from other people about what they'd said about the film. And the one thing that all of these quotes had in common, not just that the people were offended by the huge amount of insanely graphic violence in the film.
Honestly, go ahead. Sorry.
Okay, yeah. But the other thing was that there was so much style. What was it in the service of?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
What was the point of the style? Was there anything underneath it? And so that's my question to you guys.
Less than Drive, absolutely.
Definitely more style than substance this time around, for sure. The scales aren't even, for sure.
Well, like Trey said in the To the Wonder thing, though, is the style the substance?
No. My thing with, and to just kind of go back to what Trey was talking about, I didn't really feel any sort of, I don't need to be on one side of the fence or the other, you know, like I can be ambivalent towards characters. A lot of Terrence Malick movies kind of leave the decision and the choice up to you and are vague enough for you to kind of make your own conclusions and decisions and reflect back on how you would do something or how you would react. This film didn't really create any sort of like moral push-pull with me. I found it just completely disconnected. The Julian character, Gosling's character, is very quiet, very remote. But unlike the character in Drive, unlike the driver, there doesn't seem to be anything behind the scenes. The driver, even though he's another quiet, kind of stoic character, there's a moral compass and there's something to him. And I just felt like there's not anything to Gosling's character. I had a hard time connecting or relating to that.
There is, but it's not an easy hook. Here's the problem with this film, is that this hook is a difficult hook. It's an ugly hook. And that is, Ryan Gosling, his character Julian, is kind of the fulcrum of what Refn is looking at. And Refn is looking at this link between our sexuality and our frustrations with sex and with sexual interactions, and the same frustrations within violent interactions. So pairing those two is already an ugly, ugly thing, and I think one that's going to alienate most people.
Does this all come from his mommy issues?
Kind of, but not really. Yes,
I would say yes.
I would say yeah. Yeah, because there's a scene at the end with Kristen Stott.
There are two scenes that are just totally fucked up with his mom that kind of explain his sexual disconnect thing.
Yeah. So one of the things that Refn wanted to talk about was there's a frustration with sexual interaction, where it's like we never get fully what we want from that sexual interaction, because what you're striving for is emotional connectivity and sort of this psychological connectivity, but what you're dealing with is a physical interaction.
Yeah.
And so sex is always going to have some modicum of frustration to it, always. The act itself, violence is the same way, is that what you do in this violent interaction is to get some sort of, to basically even the score, to get something back, but the violence itself can't get something back. It can only take away something else.
So is this the explanation for the scene that I keep hearing about the violence against women?
You're going to have to be more specific.
Yeah, because...
There's more than one?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I mean, the
if it's the one I'm thinking of, is it the one with the brother?
I can't be more specific. I've just read reviews.
There are two... I mean, it's in some of the reviews. I'm just going to say it. The thing that his brother does is he mutilates, rapes, and kills a prostitute, a 16-year-old girl.
He doesn't... And so, he rapes,
you know,
and kills her.
He really... Yeah. You know, like, that's a... Well, he cuts her face up, too. There's... It's... So, you know, like, the challenge is set to try and identify with this revenge story from the perspective of basically degenerate bad people. And so that's tricky to begin with, but there's a scene later that's equally disturbing with Kristen Scott Thomas's character.
I mean, you know, I think there's every time she's on screen, you're kind of upset.
She plays.
She's just really.
She's over the top.
She's really great.
She's great. She's the best part of the movie, and she's more explosive than any of the action or any. You were talking about how everything delays or restricts or restrains from satisfaction or whatever. Her character is the closest thing to. Her character is like the id of the film.
Yeah.
She's just totally savage and says just fucking horrible stuff.
I honestly.
There's a dinner scene that's really disturbing.
Yeah, the dinner scene. Like, not a violent scene. A dinner scene is
it's
one
just
of the
her
most upsetting
talking
films, or
and,
one of the most upsetting
yeah, it's
scenes.
Incredible.
It is,
I mean,
so amazing.
She's on fire and she kind of embodies all that. You know, we got to wrap it up, but I gave it a minor Rock Fist Down, and I do that because I disagree. I think that Refn was totally in control. I don't think directors accidentally make movies, but I think that the movie he made was emotionally disconnected.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it was gratuitous for the sake of gratuity at times, and ultimately I think it was stylistic for the sake of style in moments, and kind of spoke to some of his weaknesses as a director. I think it missed the mark it was going for.
So is it designed to shock? Before you issue your thing, is it designed to shock, or did he actually have something to say? And if so, what was it?
I don't know that it's designed to shock, but I think that what he's exploring is something that is really, truly ugly. And so I think the nature of what he's trying to discuss in its very essence will shock. So I don't know that the goal was shocking, but it's just kind of something that's going to come along with it. So yes, I do think he has something to say. I definitely think it's a step down from Drive. I think I think Valhalla Rising actually kind of explores similar issues without the sort of sexual component.
Yeah.
Definitely through the violence issues.
It's very Oedipal.
Right. I actually probably even preferred Valhalla Rising more.
Yeah.
But whereas I gave Drive a way up, I'd give Valhalla Rising somewhere between a solid and a minor. This I'd definitely give a minor up, because I think that this is going to be a film like Irreversible, like Solo.
Where you watch it once,
but it's going to be something that once you see it, it lives in your head and forces you to kind of deal with these
issues.
I watched
it twice last night just to make sure I didn't miss something. Yeah. And I can't forget
don't
it.
Belong in the same category. One of those is an amazing masterpiece, and the other one is a piece of junk.
And the other one
is
Irreversible.
Both of them are masterpieces. I think both of them.
Irreversible is a piece of shit.
I think it's one of the most controlled, amazing. I think everything about.
Did you mean contrived?
No. I think it's controlled.
Okay.
I think everything
we'll have to
about
leave that discussion
anyway.
For later.
But yeah. So I'm giving it a minor up. I definitely think it is a misstep from him. Just coming off of Drive.
Ruffin is also a disciple of Gaspar Noé, by the way, we should mention.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So.
And it shows here. So.
And I think that's fine. I'm fine with Noé.
All right, I'm going to have to see it.
Yep. Yeah.
You definitely
you can
will.
See it
I
now.
Think this is going to be one of those that you see, you'll probably feel the same way.
You should see it and let us know. Yeah, next week you should let us know. Okay, so that was Only God Forgives. Kind of a split the difference on that. So see it if you want to. There's plenty of ways to, because it's on video on demand. But Eric, you've got a couple now to talk about. You've got The Way, Way Back. And,
yes.
What was the name of the other one?
A Hijacking.
A Hijacking, which it sounds like I should remember, because it was pretty fantastic.
We'll do a Hijacking first and make people wait for The Way, Way Back, because that's the one that people might kind of know. A Hijacking is a Scandinavian film directed by Tobias Lindquist, I believe is his name.
Okay.
I hope I don't get that wrong. It's his first movie that he's directed, but he wrote for a TV show called Borgen for a very long time, which is huge in Denmark on TV. And he's part of this movement of new realistic dark Scandinavian drama that has been around for a couple years now. And he also co-wrote The Hunt, which won Mads Mikkelsen Best Actor at Cannes this year, and is coming out in 2 weeks, and I'll be reviewing. But A Hijacking is about a tanker in the middle of the Indian Ocean that is hijacked by Somali pirates. Four of the people who were actually on the ship that is portrayed in the movie when it was hijacked for real appear in the film as sailors who are on the ship being hijacked, and a guy who actually negotiates hijackings for corporations appears as the negotiator. So you already have that element of realism. Add to that handheld camera work, the fact that there's no score, no music at all, until the end of the film.
Wow.
This is an ultra-realistic movie, half in English and half in other languages that are subtitled, because they speak many in the film. But all of the language from the Somali pirates is not subtitled. So
oh, wow.
We have the Argo treatment where, the faceless mob of angry foreigners are yelling at you and screaming at you, and you don't know what they mean. In this movie, I don't think that it's I think it works really well. I think it's very alienating, because what happens is these guys on the ship are just immediately sublimated, humiliated. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's no heroics in this film. There's no guy who you know
saves the day or gets his crew off.
They're not spending the entirety of the film hatching a plan.
Yeah,
right. They're trying to get by. They're trying not to get killed.
Right.
And the focal point is the cook on the ship, who becomes very popular because he's the one that feeds everybody.
Steven Seagal.
Yeah, Steven Seagal. Exactly. It's actually an actor who appears on many of the TV shows that they've written that this group of people are involved in. Anyway, the reason this movie is kind of genius is that the other side of the story, which is the CEO of the corporation mm-hmm. who has to deal with this ransom and try not to bankrupt his company at the same time and negotiate with the lives of his people on the ship at stake and the families coming to ask, what are you doing for us? This is a long waiting game.
Yeah.
It's horrible because the whole movie is really, what are their lives worth?
Mm-hmm.
And you feel for both sides. You're sympathetic on both ends, which is something that's kind of remarkable because we're immediately not going to side with the guys who are holding the purse strings in favor of not just letting these guys go, right?
Right.
But you can't negotiate with terrorists.
Right. So, is there a Jessica Chastain character who writes The Number of Days?
You know what? Oh, I have to say.
I'm sorry. I keep taking the air out of it. I can't help it.
No. I mean, there are no – even though Zero Dark Thirty is filmed in a very similar fashion, I would say that Zero Dark Thirty relies more on some stereotype situations that we've seen before.
Right.
Whereas this movie just kind of leaves you with a pit in your stomach and you're watching the whole time. You really do get the feeling that anything can happen. A gun could go off at any moment. But like I said, the fact that you've got the CEO on one side in a very unremarkable, boring-looking conference room and with no windows, right? And then you've got these other guys in the tanker who are down in the basement. They're shoved down below. When they run out of food, they're killing goats on board the ship for people to eat.
Wow.
And these guys are just, you know, their humanity seems to be stripped of them. And these two forces are being pushed together, and then eventually, by the end of the film, completely apart. It's pretty remarkable. It's a really effective drama, and I think it's very approachable. So if you are thinking that this sounds like a bad movie that you shouldn't go see because you don't like reading subtitles,
yeah.
Think again. There's only subtitles for about half the film. And if you're thinking, well, it sounds limiting because there's no music and it seems like, you know, this thing that's just kind of thrown together. No, it's very skillfully put together to put you in the moment. I think that Hijacking is probably one of the best films I've seen this year. The only reason I'm giving it a solid rock fist up
mm-hmm.
and not a rock fist way up is it didn't have some of those moments, those really poignant moments that make you feel like you're seeing great cinema, the stuff that
yeah.
just really excites you. Like, I'm not really excited to see this movie again, but I'm glad I lived through it once.
Yeah.
And I think the last shot of the film kind of betrays the filmmaker's, no, in yeah. a good way,
oh.
betrays his actual point of view. The whole time in the film, you're kind of challenged to make up your own mind.
Mm-hmm.
And then the very last shot of the film, I think the filmmaker gives himself away a little bit. But I kind of enjoyed that because after a point, it's like, oh, okay. Yeah, I kind of see your point. So A Hijacking, it's at the Tivoli today. I don't know how long it's going to be here, but it's a really, really strong film, and I hope people are talking about it at the end of the year for foreign language film for the Oscars.
It'll be interesting to see how, because we'll have to, one of the big Oscar bait movies that we'll have to see this fall is Captain Phillips.
That comes out this year?
Yeah.
That's the Tom Hanks thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which
Paul
is
Green,
going...
Paul Greengrass, Tom Hanks. It comes out in 2013.
Paul Greengrass.
Yeah.
So it could be the
it
same
could be
kind
good.
Of realistic
It could be
thing.
Like United 93. It could be...
Not with Tom Hanks in it, it won't be like United 93. No, I'm just saying, because in United 93, there were no recognizable actors.
Yeah.
And that's another strength of this film. We yeah. don't know any of these people.
Yeah. And that was one of my only complaints about Zero Dark Thirty, was the sort of need to insert guys like James Gandolfini and you know,
yeah.
guys like that into the film. Anyway, that
wow.
sounds great.
They really... I was thinking that the Hanks movie was coming out next year, but that... They,
nope.
That'll be interesting to see if they've already stolen their thunder by then.
Yeah. So, you know, we'll get to that when it comes out. But you'll have a good basis of comparison, though. How was Way, Way Back?
So the Way, Way Back is Nat Faxon and Jim Rash, mm-hmm. who won the Oscar 2 years ago for co-writing The Descendants.
The Dean from Community. Jim Rash, anyway.
These guys both are longtime comic actors. They started in The Groundlings. They've both been in Reno 911 and things like that. And you know, Alexander Payne took their script and reworked it with them for The Descendants. And I will say this. There is a difference between The Descendants and The Way, Way Back. And
the
I
way,
think
way back.
That is just experience. I think that Payne brings a level of depth and subtlety that they just can't quite do by themselves yet.
Yeah.
But this is a great directorial debut. They wrote, directed, and are starring in it, both in supporting roles. I think sometimes it veers a little bit too much into broad comedy, but for the most part, especially since writing my review, I kept trying to say bad things about it because I felt like it was kind of lightweight. But the more that I dug into it, this story about this 14-year-old kid who has to spend the summer at his mom's boyfriend's summer house, the more I realized that it was kind of very subtle and well done in its own right. So Steve Carell plays this guy who is his mom's boyfriend, his mom, Toni Collette.
Mm-hmm.
He's really overbearing and misguided and passive-aggressive, and he wants to force himself his way into this family. The kid, Liam James, plays the son on The Killing, Marielle Enos's son on The Killing. And I always thought he was kind of annoying on that show. He's complaining and he's bitter and he's there in small doses and kind of annoying. In this movie, he plays the most beautifully awkward kid I have ever seen.
Really?
Yeah. Like, I think major props go to Liam James for this movie because all the supporting cast, the ensemble cast, Sam Rockwell, Allison Janney,
I love
everybody.
Rockwell.
They're all great in this film, and I think that they elevate the material. I think that we've seen the coming-of-age story before. We've seen The Summer That Changed Everything.
Adventureland.
Yeah, and I like Adventureland better. I think it's a more well-rounded movie for sure. But The Way, Way Back has a lot of charm, and because the kid is so awkward and understated from the beginning, the moment of triumph, which also we could compare to Meatballs, because this is a very Meatballs movie. Summer camp, Bill Murray mentors this young kid.
Right.
I'm sure these guys watched that when they put this together. But that when the moment of triumph happens, it doesn't seem like a big moment. It's a big moment to this kid, but in another movie, it would be bigger and more obvious. If it was like a John Hughes movie, but or maybe one of the John Hughes knockoffs from the 80s
that he produced but didn't direct.
Yeah, it would be just bigger and dumber.
Yeah.
But in this film, it completely feels earned. Now, there's a couple montage scenes I could have done without. I think sometimes when they need growth, that filmmakers fall back on the montage. And it's too bad that's in this movie. But really, it's very well-written material, very funny material. The actors elevate it. Like I said, Liam James is kind of a revelation. This is going to be a big hit this summer. This will have word of mouth. Everybody will talk about it. And it'll be, in my eyes, I'm predicting kind of a My Big Fat Greek Wedding summer for this film.
That'd be great.
So I would definitely recommend seeing it, especially since there's a lot of bummer movies out there. This one will actually make you feel good. You might feel a little guilty, but you know, it's just kind of irresistible. Like, you would have to have a completely hardened heart to not be able to enjoy it.
Great. Cool. Well, that's it. That's all we've got. What was the rock fist on that?
Solid rock fist up, yeah. Cool. So it's weird. I gave that and Hijacking the same rating,
right?
But they're very different movies,
but they're
both completely successful on their own terms.
And you gave Pacific Rim the same rating, so three different movies, one rating. That just speaks to the infallibility of a rating system, my friend.
Oh my god, rating systems are the worst.
Anyway, well, we'll be back next week, but it won't be a scattershot next
time.
Next week
we've got The Wolverine. We've got Fruitvale Station.
Yep,
which I saw last night.
Yeah.
And I don't know what else. Something else. Go to the website if you want to see our review of The Conjuring, which Brian Reeves says is a great horror movie.
Great horror movie from everyone I've talked to about it. It's a fantastic horror movie.
And so Alan Rapp is going to have reviews of the two movies that we refused to see this week, Red 2 and R.I.P.D.
God bless him for it.
And he's
God
already
bless
got
you,
a review
Alan.
Of Turbo up there. So
God bless you, Alan.
That's what I say.
You magical man. All right, we're going to go. Everybody have a good weekend. We'll be back next week.
Bye.